From London, the National Broadcasting Company presents War Telescope, a review of the war week and a forecast of possible developments to come. War Telescope features Elmer Peterson of NBC's London staff, a veteran reporter of the European scene. For his regular Saturday report, we take you now to London.
This is Elmer Peterson in London. Last May, I flew to Sweden and back to Britain in a Swedish civilian passenger plane. The captain and crew of that plane, who took me safely to Stockholm and back, are now dead, apparently shot down by German planes. That happened 2 months ago. Today, we have the news that another Swedish airliner has been shot down on its way from Britain to Sweden, shot down over Swedish territorial waters with 13 lives lost, including an American clergyman. There can be no doubt but what the German fighter planes are responsible, and good reason to believe the attack was deliberate. And so, in Sweden, according to reports here in London, there is a cold, hard anger which may lead to important consequences. It's not going to bring Sweden into the war. The desire and determination to remain neutral is still dominant in Sweden. But it is going to put Swedish-German relations on an increasingly delicate basis, where anything is possible. For the Swedes may now take steps which will infuriate the Germans in turn. They undoubtedly will stop German courier planes to Sweden. Moreover, the Swedes have powerful economic weapons to turn against the Germans if they choose to do so. They can stop the shipments of iron ore and wood products to Germany, which would be a serious blow indeed. This, in turn, would be a serious thing for Sweden, which depends on Germany entirely for coal to keep Swedish industries going. But Swedish public opinion, as I know it, is becoming a powerful instrument for the Allied cause. And this isn't the first time that Swedish lives have been lost under the guns of the Germans. Moreover, the Swedish people have been both shocked and angered of late by developments in Denmark, the German measures against Danish Jews especially. Also, the Swedish people no longer feel helpless because of lack of an army and armament of their own. So, although the Swedish government is still determined to keep Sweden out of the war, Swedish public opinion has to be considered every step of the way now. In any event, this shooting down of another Swedish plane is one of those things which may, in its own way, have powerful repercussions indeed on wartime Europe. It's difficult to believe that the Germans want to invite war with Sweden, not with Sweden armed and ready for any eventualities. From recent and personal observation, I would say that the Swedes have put up a fight that, for modern skill and efficiency, for resolute fighting qualities of the soldiers, would compare with anything we've seen in this war. Swedish strategy would be, of course, to attack in Norway, to hammer a path across Norway to a Norwegian port, so that Allied supplies could come in as soon as possible. That would open the door to an Allied invasion of Norway. It would expose Germany itself to new and efficient air attack. It would give the Allies a new and powerful foothold on the continent, as far as air power against Germany is concerned, provided sufficient help could be brought to Sweden. But make no mistake about it. The Swedes, with a proud history as fighting people and with a growing anger in them, are prepared to fight if they must, and fight on the basis of some of the most intelligent preparation for war in modern history. They are the only people of a small country who are making their own tanks, guns, airplanes, warships, and submarines. Their preparations against air attack in the form of shelters and anti-aircraft guns are a model for any country. Why, then, do the Germans take the risk of getting into a war with Sweden at a time like this, when they're reeling under blows from other directions? One answer, as one views the matter here in London now, may be that the Germans are reaching a state of desperation, where they no longer care, where they will try to hit out at anyone and everyone with whom they are angry, and they are angry at the Swedes. Angry because the Swedes stopped the German transit traffic in Norway. Angry because of the way the Swedish press and public opinion is openly against them now. Still another reason may be that the Germans fear coming developments in North Europe. That they know they can't hold on in Norway without land transport across southern Sweden into Norway. That they may invite war with Sweden in order to get that land transport. The German theory would be that the Swedes could not defend southern Sweden. It may be, too, that the Germans feel that the time has come when they must take the offensive in some direction, for reasons of prestige. Also, that by attacking in North Europe again, they might divert Allied strength from other, already considered, campaigns. At any rate, London is convinced tonight that we are now approaching the great test of whether the remaining neutral countries in Europe can remain neutral. Whether, in fact, they will want to remain neutral under circumstances yet to arise. Portugal is ready for any emergency. Turkey, bound by alliance to Britain, may yet see an active role in this war, at least defensively. And all neutrals are under the shadow of Germany's determination to prolong the war, cost what it may, in hopes of finding disagreement among the Allies, in hopes of getting a favorable peace. It's something that's being watched very closely here in Britain now. And one thing is certain. If any of Europe's remaining neutrals are forced into a last-minute participation in this war, they will receive the cooperation of the Allies in forms not possible even a year ago. Among other things, the British and American navies are now in a position to give effective assistance, not only with ships, but with carrier-borne planes. Through a high degree of cooperation between themselves, our navies are now in a position to strike effectively in any new fields of activity, and it's something worth considering. Just a few weeks ago, as example, an American aircraft carrier moved swiftly through the cold waters of the North Atlantic. The circumstances were unusual, for this American carrier was operating with a British home fleet. For the first time, we learned that American war vessels had been on offensive operations in this particular theater of war, sailing alongside British ships. While out in the Pacific, it's been revealed here in London, the British aircraft carrier Victoria spent months as part of an American task force, serving under an American admiral. And the cooperation would carry a step further there. As a matter of tactical necessity, a British fleet air squadron operated for a time from an American carrier, while American pilots had a chance to fly off the deck of the Victorious. Meanwhile, the latest types of American Navy planes, Corsairs and Hellcats, are now being used on British carriers. Now, as far as broad strategy is concerned, these examples of British and American naval cooperation have their obvious significance. Real cooperation requires understanding, a pooling information. It means that the American and British navies must be able to work together, not only in Admiralty and Navy Department conference rooms, but in all those small details of operation which go to make up successful naval action. It means also that the men of the British and American navies must understand each other, get along with each other, be able to talk the same language when it comes to action. It's important also that this cooperation should be developed to a fine point when it comes to aircraft carriers. More and more, it must be recognized, the aircraft carrier is coming into the war picture in all theaters of war, just as it has carried a heavy load of the attack in the Pacific. In fact, the functioning of the aircraft carrier is going to be revealed in amazing forms before this war is over. So far, we can only visualize the final blows at Japan, when a combined Allied fleet will go into action. When a tremendous concentration of carrier-borne planes will deal out their destruction over and above the big guns of that fleet. Then have an impressive function in whatever forms of international policing against war is set up. In that police force, the Navy is going to have a leading role, perhaps the lead role, for Navy guns and carrier-borne aircraft in all parts of the world. This cooperation between British and American aircraft carriers now has its human side. Here in London, I've been talking to the commander of the British Air Squadron, which served for a time aboard an American carrier in the Pacific. The story is a strange one in its way. The story of British Navy pilots and mechanics suddenly transferred from their own ship, from a routine and discipline that was second nature to them, to a ship where a new routine had to be mastered, where a new way of life was encountered. There were little things, this British pilot said, that made a lot of difference in the beginning, being routed out for general quarters without being handed a cup of tea when awake. Learning to drink coffee and eat gallons of ice cream. On the technical side, learning new signals for landing. But once the changeover was made, proved entirely successful. Out of close association, the British and American pilots and their crews gained mutual respect for each other. And the things which impressed British pilots were such things as the endless efficiency of American mechanics. The calmness and discipline, he said, of the Americans when in action. The way in which the American pilots and crews and mechanics worked at their job at all hours of night and day. Using their leisure hours, even, to study and learn. Now, all this raises the question of what an American carrier pilot thinks of working in close cooperation with a British fleet. And so today, we have with us here in NBC's London studio, a pilot from the carrier which saw action in the North Sea recently with the British home fleet. We can't give you the name of this pilot, but we can ask him some questions. So what about it, Lieutenant? Are there any serious problems or difficulties in going into action with a fleet other than your own?
There are some difficulties, of course, but from my point of view, they're not serious ones. That's been proven by this time.
Well, how would you feel, Lieutenant, if ordered, say, to fly your plane off a British carrier?
Well, there wouldn't be much trouble about a thing like that. There's a matter of different signals, of course, but signals can be learned. The main thing is to have confidence in the way your landings and takeoffs are handled and directed.
And you American pilots have that confidence?
Of course. We might be a bit uneasy at first, but that's the...
Well, what about life aboard a British aircraft carrier as compared with your own?
Well, I'd probably prefer my own, but then that's understandable. After all, there's a great feeling of pride in your own ship, the space you've been... been on her for a long time. Things. Still, I must say there are some nice things. Well, the British seem to go in, seem to color easy chairs.